lineouts, racks.
Halls engage.
What an amazing try.
Tries and tackles, dissected by South Africa's top rugby minds.
That is world class.
This is To The Last Drop, your weekly in-depth rugby podcast with Liam Delcombe and Brendan Nell.
This is To The Last Drop. I'm Liam Delcombe.
And I'm Brendan Nell.
Brendan, you've got a nice tan after your long travels, your mini break. It looks like you got a lot of sun. I take it you enjoyed it. You look like a man that's lapped it all up.
Yeah, I have. I must admit, I was in South America, as you know, maybe our listeners don't know. I went there for holidays. Argentina's been the one part, Liam, you've toured as a record journalist I've never had the pleasure of doing. And it was a bit of a bucket list destination, Buenos Aires, for me. So I made a plan, and I ended up in a couple of other cities as well, in Montevideo in Uruguay, and Salvador in Brazil, and Sao Paulo in Brazil, and just soaked it all up. And South America is definitely a vibe. It's definitely got an energy about it that's it's hard to explain to someone, but it's certainly worthwhile visiting if you ever do get the chance. Other than the fact you're going to have way too many caipirinhas, there's going to be more than enough to keep you busy there. I had the advantage of seeing our old friend Frankie Dega as well, as in Buenos Aires as well. Had lunch with him as well.
Buy him a beer, did you?
Yeah. No. Frankie's a teetotaler, as we all know. So, but it was good to catch up with it, even though it was a bit brief. But I loved it. Buenos Aires is an amazing city. I can understand why it's so highly rated and people call it the Paris of South America.
Well, I think it's a city with the huge energy. Sometimes the economy isn't doing that well, but it doesn't break the spirit of people who live there. They certainly still get out and about and enjoy life to the full. I mean, welcome back. I suppose you, don't know if you're from long distance, how much you've watched over the last couple of days, but let me remind you, the Springboks are one game away from completing an end-of-year clean sweep. They won in Edinburgh, they won in London, and now it's on to Cardiff, where Wales are lying wait. The Dragon hasn't breathed the same amount of fire it has in past years. And although they're on a bit of a losing streak, you know, it's still a game the Springboks need to take seriously, because they have slipped up before on end-of-year tours where there's only one hurdle to overcome and then suddenly you find yourself tripping into it.
Yeah, I can imagine, because a lot of these players, especially, you know, a couple of these, the Sharks players, for instance, and the Stormers players and the Bulls players, were all on a three-week tour just before this tour. And they sort of got home and then went off to Jersey and then were away now for another 3 weeks. And in the Bulls' case, they're heading off for another couple of weeks as soon as they get home. So, yeah, not much time. And I mean, while they are professional players and, yeah, they do get paid to do what they do, anybody knows when you're away from home for so long, those little things are the things that can trip you up. And your Bucks have in the past been tripped up by that one foot on the plane syndrome. It happens to every sports team in the world at times. But I don't think so. I don't think it was though. I think there's a lot of excitement to some of the new caps that they brought in. I did get to watch both the Scotland and the England games. Scotland one I watched on the bus between a place called Colonia and Montevideo, which was quite fun. And then and I watched, when I got back on the weekend, a replay of the Bok England game, because Sao Paulo's airport Wi-Fi wasn't good enough to watch video. But I did
not include airport, I have to say.
No, not at all. Probably the only downside of that the entire trip was that just on both performances. I mean, and we have spoken a bit about the past parts, but in both performances, the Bucks have found ways to win, haven't been overly impressive, have looked a bit vulnerable, have had parts of their game where they can improve, but they still won, and they won comfortably in both games. So this week is a very different challenge, because Wales it reminds me of a lot where South Africa was after that end of year tour. I think it was 2016 where they lost against
2016 it was pretty bad, and then they copped a number of losses in 2017 as well. You need to be satisfied.
Well, I think it was 2017. I still remember beating him and Adrian Strauss on when they returned home, and there was nobody at the airport except for a few of us journalists, and we had to put some tough questions to Alistair about having the worst record of the Springbok coach, and Adrian Strauss, he's a hell of a nice guy, having the worst record of a Springbok captain, and wasn't the most comfortable press conference to have. It feels very much the same in Wales this week. Everybody's pointing fingers. Everybody's looking, you know, who to blame. And I think everybody accepts that Warren Gatland's on the way out. But they've got this small matter of the world champions coming this week. And so what do? You put up a, you hope to put up a brave performance, but I think there's an inevitability there. And that could be dangerous in the way for the Springboks, because if you let your guard down, you think the game's going to be easy. It just takes one bounce the ball and you're behind 7-0. Not that this side can't claw their way back from the strangest of positions, but there is still something to play for, still some danger there in the box.
Look, I mean, if you look at the Springboks, I think they haven't yet delivered a polished performance on this tour. They've won, I think, both those tests, especially the second one. They've used their champion qualities to stand tall when they needed to. Got a more than a brave defense when the opposition came knocking. And just barely to dig deep, even though the lineup wasn't always working, the scrum was a bit wonky, especially in the second half against England. I mean, they lost some of the authority they had in the first half. They weren't great at the ruck in Edinburgh. So despite all these things, they still find ways of winning, and that's what champion teams do. So I think the need to finish off the tour and do it with some authority, I think, is important to them. And then I think also the fact that they have slipped up in those last games on tour before, in 2018, for instance. I know they lost the first game of that tour to England by a point, but then they also lost to Wales in the last one, which was a little bit unexpected in that if you look at the personnel that was gathered for that game, you'd have expected the box to win. I mean, they had Kitsoff and Mulhaber, had his name on as a starting line. I think even Etzebeth was off the bench. Sia played, Peter Steff played. It was still a very strong side, and they slipped up then. And then, of course, end of year 2021 against England, the last one, they also lost by a point, also with a strong team. So I think there's enough there to put them on high enough alert this week to try and deliver a proper performance. And you're right, I think the squad they've put together for this particular fixture is just about spot on.
Yeah, I think the one thing about Wales, which we've seen over the years, and maybe not the last two or three fixtures, is they're the one team who don't really have an issue about standing up physically to the box. They actually quite enjoy it. They don't always get it right, let's put it that way. But I mean, the physicality part, which everybody else talks about. I mean, I listened to a podcast last week while I was traveling of Courtney Laws telling everybody who would listen how England had to give them the box faces. The only way they were going to win was to dominate them up front. And I thought to myself, geez, if we could roll out every cliche that's been spoken about the box in the last 30 years, that'd probably be it. And they're not quite that team anymore. Wales normally enjoy the physical part, and they've got some players that can stand up the physical part. Not always for 80 minutes. And I think where they...
About to make the point. I've seen this movie before where it's huff and puff and it's 65 minutes and then suddenly there's a moment. You don't want the likes of... And I'm talking about previous tours, of course. I mean, a guy like Willem Albers running at you all the time.
Yeah.
That's not the most pleasant thing. You may make the first five tackles, but eventually there's going to be a soft shoulder.
Yeah, and I think that's why. I think the box just, with that sort of going forward ball, the way they're playing at the moment, they get good quality ball on the outside. They manage to make sort of gaps and open up defenses a lot more. And I think if you're on the receiving end of that sort of punishment for 65 minutes, there are going to be a lot of gaps. And the one thing I do think counts a lot in this box side's favour, not only that number one and all this stuff, is that players like Jordan Hendricks played in July against Wales. So he had a nervy start there. He's now selected with his brother. I think there's going to be a lot of excitement amongst them, amongst their family, and amongst some of the other players for this, because it is a very interesting, intriguing combination of boxing. So he shouldn't be as nervy as he was at cricket. He should be a lot more settled. And I think when you look at that, the backline they picked outside him was basically the backline from last week at Twickenham against England. So there's enough quality out there. And on the inside, Sia and Jasper, I know Elrich's also there, but probably Elrich doesn't have as many caps as the rest of the guys and probably still playing his way into a more permanent spot in the box team. But the two halfbacks certainly have enough experience around them And there's also the insurance on the bench of Andre Kurbis Reinef, that there's not much to worry about. The one I'm excited about, there is Cameron Honeycomb on the bench. And I mean, I've received a couple of messages from Welsh mates who said it's so good that he's on the bench that he can see what happens in the first half and then do WWF style, make the big reveal and then take off his jacket and have a Welsh jersey on. Some of my Welsh friends believe that's going to happen. I said they've been watching too much. I was thinking
about the attitude, but yeah.
But yeah, I mean, look, anyone who spoke Cameron, I think he said it many times as well. Wales was never an option for him. It was more media thing driven on that side. And I can't wait to see him take the field. Interesting to see whether he'll take the field at 8 or at 6 or at 7, because he can play all three. I think long-term, he's probably more going to settle at 6. But it depends who's on the field at that stage and I suppose what the scoreline is.
Yeah, no, it is an exciting element. And I think, without any further ado, we should probably listen to what the head coach, Rassie Erasmus, had to say about it and maybe a word or two from Cameron.
In these excerpts from the press conference and the team announcement, Rassie talks about Warren Gatland, the pressure he's under, and his own sort of way of managing his team and using 52 players this year and when they will settle on the squad.
Yeah, I think more importantly, I think they deserve, we've been chopping and changing and we're really testing different combinations and we could have played Kurbis, Herschel, the Yankees, there's so many guys who's played for us in this year, even Mordmay of the Lions, you know, but each forced that it worked out for the two brothers. They deserve a chance together. Jordan had one chance, and I mean, Jaden is pretty settled in our team. So we're glad for them, but I think more than the family thing, that's a warm, fuzzy feeling, but the performance is very important. Yeah, as I always say, you know, it's very tough to talk about other people's situation, but since you asked the question, I'll try and answer it as best I can. Obviously, we were totally different. We were a new coaching staff that came in, and then it's easy to start a new culture because it's almost like a new start. But I think Wales is in a totally different scenario just for the sake of Warren can't all of a sudden become a bad coach with his track record. And the players that they have, if you look at them individually, they are definitely. There's some world-class players in there. I know the record of losing 11 in throat is obviously not great, but whenever we play a team that's backs against the wall, if I can put it that way, well, we take ourselves back just before I took over. I think we lost 57-0 in New Zealand, but then the next weekend we lost by the same team against New Zealand at Newland by 2 points, and that was a weekend apart. So I don't know. I just know Warren is a great coach, and I do know they've got great players. And whatever is not clicking quite there, I think he is a guy who has fixed things before, but deeper than I've been that, I don't know the world set up to that. I think first of all, as you know, you can't plan everything around the World Cup. You know, if a guy's age is now 34 or 35, and he wants to end his rugby international career in 2026, you can't take that away from him because he won't be ready in 2027. A lot of players do plan their careers around World Cups. I've said it many times, a World Cup is sometimes just 6 tough games. Sometimes you put it where it's one really tough game, and then maybe if you're lucky, 2 easier ones. And then in a quarterfinal, semifinal, final, where a rugby championship says 6 tough games, you know you can lose on the day. Not to say that the Tier 2 nations, they're definitely coming up like all of us see. But it's unfair towards players getting older who are still good enough and the best in their position, which might not make 2027, to leave them out just because you are planning towards a World Cup. You must give those guys as much opportunity as we can. So I think what you've seen this year, hopefully you've seen that, is that we're trying to prolong careers. And I can't tell you who's not going to make it, who's going to make it. But that's why we are trying and sifting. But I guess probably, not that it's cast in stone, but I think probably next year after the incoming series, going into the rugby championship, then we'll probably settle on a 33 or 35. I think you can see also that we disrespect no team by chopping and changing. It's just the way we knew we lost 2020. with COVID, and we tried to maximize this year while through that. But I guess from next year, Rugby Championships, we will start just picking the in-form players. Not necessarily even go deep to the World Cup. Sam was still the best in the position, but might just stop in the year before the World Cup. Sorry for the long ones. Yeah, no, I tried. And that's where we lost. I can't remember. The warm-up match before the World Cup. And we had a good chat there, you know, about the Lions series. And it's just how coaching becomes lonely and coaching becomes cutthroat. And, you know, whenever somebody's under the pump, you know, you don't wish anything bad on that coach. And, no, I wouldn't say I would love him to beat us, but I would love him to be successful. And you know, although we bumped some heads in the past, he's a rugby man through and through. And we've certainly had very decent discussions since. And I've got a lot of respect for him. And I hope he gets the respect from everybody which he deserves.
Cameron Honeycomb then gave his version of how it feels to become a Springbok. He's making his debut this weekend off the bench. Of course, was targeted by Wales, but decided South Africa was always his first choice.
No, I must say, so it's being a child, Spiro Jim, who's played for the Springboks, and I mean, becoming reality on Saturday, it's unbelievable. Like, feeling, I'm really grateful for it, and I'm really privileged to be here, and I'm taking the opportunity with both hands.
Nice.
It never crossed my mind. Honestly, small media that speculated it. But yeah, I've always been, since a young boy, I've always dreamed of playing the Springboks, and yeah, it's always been the dream.
The other thing about this fixture, which is quite intriguing, is I know Rossi said as well that they buried the hatchet here, but there's quite a history between the two of them. It's feisty history. And I mean, you and I were both around in the 21, that bizarre British and Irish Lions tour. And while Rossi was made the villain by everybody because of the video of the refs, Gatlin was doing his fair share behind the scenes to pull strings and to, you know, drive the media narrative, especially amongst the UK press. So there's no love lost between those two. I hope they have both buried the hatchet, as they say they have. But it would be rather ironic if Rossi actually ends Gatlin's Wales career this week.
There's probably every possibility that would happen. I mean, if you have that kind of losing streak, if Warren Gatland wasn't in charge of Wales, if it was any other coach, that coach would probably have lost his job by now. If, you know, over a losing streak that stretches over double digits. I mean, so yeah, I suppose there's every chance of that stretching out to 12, and and then obviously Wales have to do something about it, and that would be probably the most obvious thing.
Yeah, I think the one thing that also comes to mind is just, you know, what does it mean in the long term for Welsh rugby? Because we've been there before with South African rugby, and you need to make the right decisions when you're in a situation like this. And the Boks did make the right decision in bringing in Rossy Rasmus. A new coach is going to want certain things. I'm not quite sure the Welsh club system is all that it should be at the moment. And they've got a number of problems themselves in terms of that. So it might just be, doesn't matter who the coach is that they bring in, the environment needs to change in a lot of ways. And I think that's a much bigger task for Wales rugby as well. So we're thinking of our Wales friends. We really enjoyed them. They're good people to have a beer with. A pint of braids. There's certainly some brains needed in the way they head forward in this, in the way they plot their path forward after this test.
And there's your To The Last Drop contribution right there.
Yeah, anyone who's had brains will understand what he's saying. It's a lovely beer in Cardiff. It'll always be one of the funniest ones for me to name a beer brains, but anyway.
Yeah, look, Cardiff is a wonderful city. It's a wonderful destination. If you're a rugby fan, if you have an affinity for the sport, it's just test match week is just something else there, especially from about Thursday night onwards, because fans start coming in, and then from the Friday, people from around Wales start coming in, and it's just, yeah, that's Cardiff. It becomes a wonderful rugby town, rugby city for test match weekend. So I'm sure fun will be ahead this weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, you sort of sparked a thought here. Yeah, we talk a lot about test rugby in places like that. I mean, Edinburgh, a couple of weeks ago, another fantastic city to go watch rugby. And then if you're listening to this and you haven't had the chance, if you do ever get the chance, it's so worth it to stand in those hallowed stadiums
and listen to national anthems being sung. It's fine to me. It's a rugby experience. If I've done it, I've been very glad I experienced it. I would recommend it to any rugby fan. And then we get these reports coming out. You and I haven't had a chance to talk about it, but of this breakaway pro league that's going to come, and there's all this American money that's going to back and take 280 professional players out of the game and have this traveling circus to rugby stopping grounds like Chicago, Houston, all these places that they reckon they're going to take teams to play every week in the competition. Well, that's what's been muted, this IPL-type style competition. My first reaction is, we've seen this movie before. Rugby, other than the normal obstacle of actually just getting rugby to sanction, which I don't think will happen, because you take 280 top players out of the game, you probably destroy the test game, and you probably destroy all club games around, franchises around the world. But I'm not sure if that's sustainable. I don't know. It sounds to me it's like somebody looking for the next best thing. It's a great headline. It's, again, faceless PR people who are sort of beaking these stories. But I haven't seen anybody of consequence come out and just say, this is a good idea. Your thoughts?
I think, firstly, you have to say that I think it's wonderful that they're trying to do something, and that rugby, in that neck of the woods, probably needs to get some jet fuel in it and, you know, go places. However, I think, again, with this kind of scheme, if you try and be disruptors, and often with these things, when it's not being, the plan isn't sort of fully on the table yet, that people make statements and they kind of just wait to see what happens. But what is the fallout? Well, how is this received? And our friends in the English media, as far as I can tell so far, they haven't been particularly complimentary or receptive to this new idea. And it's going to be a hard sell. I mean, I don't see World Rugby jumping at it. They are obviously quite keen for the game to take off in the States. But the way in which this now has been proposed, I don't think is going to be something that they be keen to bite.
I also just think, I'm no marketing guru. We've both seen people in the past try and sort of conquer America, whether it's in a sporting thing or musically. I mean, you hear all the time how difficult it is for any sort of pop group or other music group from across the world to break through in America. It's a very unique culture. It's a very distinct culture. And probably you would say at the moment, a very fractured culture around there at the moment as well.
So, four guys from Liverpool can do it, Brendan. I mean, it's...
Well, those four guys from Liverpool were a while back. Not many of them have done it since then. So the point being is that it's just a very difficult place to conquer as such. And what it means for the rest of the game, I think there's going to be some... If it does go ahead, or if there's any sort of concrete plans... I come back to my old gripe of fixing the global game first, because the one thing these last couple of weeks have shown, and I dare anybody to have this conversation, is the one thing that the last couple of weeks have shown, the drama of the last 3 weeks, when you're watching Ireland, New Zealand, or France, New Zealand, or your Springboks playing, is that there's something on the line. There's drama. There's something to play for each team. And that's, to me, I mean, club rugby games tend to come and go, and there's some great ones that come around. But in the test arena, that's still the pinnacle for me. And when you see some of the games that we've seen the last couple of weeks, you can understand why.
Yeah, I mean, the global season is something that we, how many times have we spoken about this over the last 2 decades, if not longer? Last year, during the World Cup, we were in the media center, and there was an email that came through, and soon we were kind of ushered into an auditorium, and then Bill Beaumont and a couple of other senior people, including the CEO, they're not baked the news because we kind of all anticipated it, but they were trumpeting this new path towards a global season, and it made it sound like it's a done deal. We know now, more than a year down the line, that what they were selling then was just complete, they were just blade smoke. I mean, we're not anywhere closer to securing a global season. But it was done with a fair amount of fanfare. The Wolves, the rugby media, certainly assembled in one room. And 1 year down the line, they haven't moved forward.
Sounds like most things that ball rugby do, unless they tinker it with balls.
Tinkerwitch. So they have a new chairman, Brendan. Maybe things will change.
They do. Brett Robinson, former Wallaby flanker. I must admit, the initial stuff I've read coming out of the election hasn't given me much hope. It sounds more like more and more of the same old platitudes being said. I do find it very interesting that Australia Rugby has the chairmanship now, seeing as they have been pushed so hard by World Rugby over the last couple of years. World Rugby, of course, bailed them out in COVID when they were bankrupt. They've got the Lions Tour, and they also get the World Cup given to them. So, and now the chairmanship of World Rugby. The thing that comes with that chairmanship is that is so easy just to protect the interests of the top 8 or 10 nations in World Rugby. If you're going to make fundamental change, you really need to make some bold decisions. I'm not quite sure from the initial statements that have been made off the election that we're going to see any bold changes. I think it's going to be more of the same, more lurching into the same
world. Well, I mean,
yeah.
As you said earlier, it's just the normal stuff. I mean, there was nothing in the sort of bullet points, the things that he will be driving in the next 4 year term that got you sitting up thinking, okay. Unlike, I would say, when Augustine Pichot ran a couple of years ago against Bill Beaumont, there was the real promise of a big shakeup in rugby, and of course he got voted down. But in Robinson's case, I mean, it's the normal things. I mean, it's just the financial sustainability, it's the execution of the next phase of world rugby's global growth. What does that mean? It's things like competitions that drive audience engagement. Well, we've had that one a few times as well.
Well,
fan and player growth investment.
What does that even mean?
There's nothing exciting there. And we probably also have to add that he wasn't necessarily South African rugby's horse the day. I mean, their support is behind the former French flanker in running it. Abdel Benazi, who fell just short after the second round of voting because he got 25 votes and Robinson 27. So it was desperately close.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, nothing that you mentioned there, those bullet points, really excites me. But to me, I want to, and that's one of the things, we never really get a chance to have a sit down. Because these guys are all based in Europe, they tend to, when they do interviews, do it with European media and mostly friendly media, let's be honest. But they don't really sit down, get a little break before adversarial interviews. So there's questions that I want to ask. For instance, what's the influence of Middle Eastern money going to be in terms of you wanting to get financial stability for it? There's obviously several other questions that come ahead to that if you start taking money from those parts. We've also seen that just by giving more money to billionaires like golf has done, hasn't really improved the game. It hasn't really taken over golf. In fact, you could probably argue the opposite. It's probably cheapened the game in a way. So there's those type of questions. What happens if you have this test league that's going to go ahead? What happens to nations like Georgia, Portugal, Spain, who've shown some real promise in the last couple of years at fans over at World Cups? What happens to that? And how does rugby actually grow from just beyond a team sport? I don't know. I don't see those answers. I'm not quite hopeful we can ever get them. But I suppose we have to wait and see and have to give a chance.
Yeah.
I'd be more surprised if anything does it.
Yeah, it almost sounds like this is a podcast on its own. I mean, there's enough fodder there to have the podcast on its own. So it's probably a matter we should, let for now. We'll give them the opportunity to do whatever they've set out to do.
Well, I'll put out some feelers, take a long sort of fishing rod and throw it over to Dublin and see if anybody there wants to talk about it. Don't be surprised if we don't, but it's maybe worth throwing a line. But one thing World Rugby has done.
Go there if it makes things easier.
One thing World Rugby has done well, I've got to give it credit for it. The World Rugby Player of the Year Awards were announced, the nominees. Get announced next week. Out of the four nominees, three South Africans, although there's one glaring omission, which is I suppose not surprising, she is props never get nominated for Rugby Player of the Year. Just a caveat on that. What normally happens is there's a panel of ex-test players who get asked to vote every week during the international season. Those votes get tallied, and that's how they sort of make the short list. That's obviously got some flaws because you hope that everybody's watching the game the same way. But players tend to favor players who get man of match awards or have sort of starring roles in games. That's why props never really get there. But I think Oxenchair can feel very aggrieved. He's not a natural person, probably the one player that should be there. But Cheslin Kolbe, Peter Steph-Detroy, Evan Etzebeth, and Kalen Doris, the odd one out. Although he has had a good season, got to give him credit. He led Ireland well against the box and has been a standout performer for Ireland in test matches. But you can't see anybody else but those three, one of those three getting it.
The question then is, Brendan, what do you leave out of that, that little assembly?
Well,
to make room for us.
Well, as a South African, I think probably know what my answer would be there. But I suppose they have to show that it's not just favoring one country, because you'd have all sorts of other complaints from other parts.
Yeah, look, I mean, it would be nice for the props plump to have one in there. And look, I mean, the season has just been stellar. There's no doubt. I can't think of too many tight ends who dominated him this year. Or even last year, for that matter. I think the his role in that position, he's kind of making his own as well, because he gets around. He's got this work rate, and you can almost see when they're ready to set for a scrum that the opposition, they just never look that keen.
Yeah. Now you get that sort of, yeah. Especially when the first scrum doesn't get set, you get those bewildered looks in that front row, you know. We all know what's happening, and we quite enjoy watching that. So, but I feel for Ox, Southerns don't win scrums, and they don't seem to win awards either. So on the other three, it's a very difficult one, because all three are worthy. Cheslin probably the star power, the standout in terms of those special moments that they could put on the highlight reel. Although Peter Steph-Detroy could have probably won it in the last 4 years, to be very honest, because he's just been so relentless in the way he plays. And Evan never has a bad game. So I'm not sure who I'd give it to. I'd probably say Peter Steph should be the one who gets it. But saying that, there's probably back of my mind, I said, geez, how do you not give it to Evan? Yeah, he should have probably got it last if the World Cup.
If I have to choose between those two, and it's very, very difficult at that, I'd probably give it to Evan by a very short margin, a very, very small margin. Not much, you know. But I mean, he's been absolutely colossal when he's needed to be colossal. So, in terms of those two, he did man out of there. I mean, Kolbe is just in the stratosphere. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
And then you look at the breakthrough player of the year. Obviously, a couple of months ago, we probably all would have given it to Sacha Feinberg and Ngoma Zulu. But Wallace Setiti has had an exceptional season. And I know there's two other candidates there as well for that, but I can't see anybody other than Wallace Setiti. I suppose it depends what they're looking for and how those voting process goes. But I think Setiti's probably going to be, and I think because South Africans, we probably acknowledge that probably is a fair result if he does get it.
Yeah, absolutely. Setiti has been immense. And it's a shame about Sacha, because if he had he was certainly on course to have a nice full season, because, I mean, he got a lot of game time in his first, eight tests. And, you know, if it was on this end of year tour, I always think of these end of year tours where before these awards or these nominations are made, you know, if you put in a good end of year tour, a couple of one or two man of the match performances, you were a pretty decent job. So his timing probably just wasn't right.
Yeah. I'll mention one of the others, not going to go through all of them, because there's a bunch of those awards. And we still haven't heard Coach of the Year, Team of the Year, but I think South African Rossi should be very close for that one as well. On the sevens front, and the one that brings up debate.
Oh, I know. I think I know where you're going to go with this.
World Rugby has
DuPont.
DuPont has been nominated, despite the fact that he played three out of the eight tournaments. In the Olympics, in all the games, he played off the bench, and then had a magnificent final where he scored two tries. He was certainly the face
of the Olympics. That's why the man was there. To be fair,
It was, but when you play 3 out of 8 tournaments, and fair enough, France did well in those 3 tournaments he played. He's certainly an exceptional player. That's not knocking his pedigree. But when they award supposed to be over the course of a season, and you have to take 8 tournaments, a final, and an Olympics into account, you're supposed to judge out of 10. So if his performances in 4 tournaments are better than anybody else that played 10 tournaments, fair enough. I just think the message you send out to guys who are on the 7th circuit week in and week out, is one, a typical one from Ireland, you know, world rugby, unfortunately. Mm. Nick Maloof from Australia, I thought was very unlucky not to be there. Terry Kennedy, who is nominated, had a sensational season 5. You know, it should be, to me, was one of the guys who should have been. And yeah, I just tried to find, but I suppose it's the law of averages. If DuPont doesn't get the award, it'd probably be a bigger outcry. Maybe I'm just being
put the season. I mean, with Antoine Dupont, there's been a lot of chat around him the last couple of weeks. And it's amazing how South Africans get involved in those debates, because there are some comparisons being drawn. I mean, the man has star power, there's no doubt. And having watched the All Blacks against France last Saturday, he probably didn't have the impact he would have normally in matches. But even when he has, by his standards, a fairly average game, there is still just so much that he does that he makes it easy. It's just, there's a level of ridiculousness there that is quite astounding.
Yeah, Mr. DuPont's going to stir up conversation. We never really hear the end of it, of course. Being a player that's played 25 minutes in the Southern Hemisphere in his whole career. But we'll leave that for another part and another debate. There's been a lot to talk about. We've enjoyed this one, even though we didn't have a guest. It's been good to be back here and looking forward to see what Cameron Hanekom and Jordan Hendrickson can do this weekend. It's going to be a big match.
It's going to be a big, you know, it's a nice way for the Boks to the end of the year. And there's a good chance they'll do it with a bit of a spree in their step.
That's it for us. We'll chat to you next week. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. For the latest insights and rugby analysis each week, plus new episode alerts, please follow or subscribe to the series. Or find all episodes at jacaranda.fm.com or the Jackpot app.